Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, California's recent surge in COVID-19 cases has some parents wondering how safe it is for kids to continue outdoor sports or organized outdoor play. While the state prohibits competitive games, in July it began allowing some team training and conditioning. We'll take stock of what we've learned so far from youth leagues and from schools doing PE or group play at recess about how to do it safely and how to apply those lessons at home. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Kids in youth sports leagues or whose parents have chosen in-person school have been participating in some form of group play or PE classes amid the pandemic. Sports and organized play build critical social skills as well as keep kids healthy. In this hour of Forum, we take stock of what we've learned so far about how kids can play together safely and if it's still safe given the state's recent surge in cases. Joining me is Michelle Serrano, Vice President of Field Operations for Playworks, an organization that creates opportunities for kids to play as safely as possible and advise school districts on recess and play. Welcome to Forum, Michelle Serrano.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Stanford. Glad to have you here as well, Dr. Maldonado.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Michelle Serrano, I will actually start with you. You know, for those elementary schools that have gone back in person, can you paint us a picture of what a school playground or what PE might look like now, how it's changed to deal with the pandemic?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly some things have changed, and then we are seeing some similarities when it comes to the smiles and laughter that students are experiencing. But in this moment, we have schools where you can step out onto the playground and you will see clearly marked play areas that either maybe it's like a circle of cones, it's tape, chalk, paint to kind of distinguish the game and what's being played in that area so students can quickly identify that. There typically is also a playground map that shows students what the options are for that day. And you'll see, you know, a lot of thought and intention go into how students even transition out of class into the recess time, you know, with fun things like walk like a penguin or do your dinosaur roar so that they're engaged in another movement or mindset, you know, to try to avoid all of the hand-holding and hugging that they once did. And then they come out to a number of games that are physically distant but still socially engaging. You'll see things like relay races and with rock, paper, scissors to resolve a conflict, you know, cooperative games like red light, green light, or games where students are listening to an instruction and following that, you know, following their coach in that movement or that action. So there are still a number of ways that students are able to step onto the playground, be, like I was saying, socially distant, but still are physically distant, but still socially engaged.
And at the elementary school level, they are wearing masks as well as they do these activities?
Yes, yes, they are.
And you mentioned that you sort of coned off all of these separate areas. What is that for? Is that to have sort of small groups and very distinct activities? And how do you determine how to do that and how to make that as safe as possible?
Yeah, so it's definitely something that we work side by side with each of our partner schools on determining what space do they have available, what systems have they set up, what groups typically, you know, we're seeing that schools are much more confident and clear on keeping students within their small groups, within their learning environments, you know, within their grade levels. And then we create the opportunity for those students to step out into the playground with those groups, but have a very inviting and engaging space to do that in, so that that same intention and proactive, you know, approach towards safety is followed outside as well, but in a way that is disguised in a very positive and engaging environment, like I was saying, with colorful cones to mark off areas, signs, positive language chalked out on the playground, encouraging, you know, air high fives, or pass a smile to a friend versus, you know, giving those in-person high fives or just kind of as like we were saying, these proactive strategies for how to keep them engaged.
What schools are you working with right now?
Yeah, so we have a number of schools across the state, both in Southern California and Northern California. In Southern California, it's primarily LAUSD, along with a couple of other school districts in the Inland Empire and San Bernardino County that all right now are currently virtually offering education and engagement for their students. And then in Northern California, we have schools in East Palo Alto, Oakland Unified, Sunnyvale, also in West Contra Costa and Woodside. So kind of a handful of schools that we're seeing similar approaches and sometimes and definitely, you know, differences within their platforms and their schedules.
And it sounds like, as you were saying earlier, that the reactions of kids is still very positive, you know, like before times where they're not necessarily, especially in the way that you've designed the activities and tried to encourage positive things, like rather than saying, don't give a high five, because it's, you know, you're saying give an air high five kind of thing, that they are really benefiting from it and not responding to what feel like new limitations.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we were so mindful as I was saying, our educators and our school partners, that so many students haven't been able to be in person engaging with their peers and their friends and their teachers. And so, you know, returning to an environment that was filled with, you know, don't touch this and don't go there and do these things was something that, you know, we really took the opportunity to work with them to say, how can we create a space where they can still feel connected and engaged and have fun, certainly experience some joy for so many students who haven't had the chance, for some of them, to play in person or outside since March.
Yvonne Maldonado, how important is this kind of group play, team play for kids, young kids especially?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear from the American Academy of Pediatrics standing, as well as most of us as pediatric providers, that we really know that children need to be engaged in physical activity. It's really important for their physical health and mental health and well-being. It really does help them engage with each other in social skills as well. So it's really an important opportunity for them throughout the year to be able to build on their physical and intellectual and social development.
So what can happen to kids who don't get enough of this kind of interaction and physical activity?
Well, there are a number of studies over the years demonstrating that children who don't get enough physical activity really just, they do have a different, they can lag behind in development, and they can also wind up with physical manifestations, you know, increasing obesity rates, for example, risk for diabetes and other metabolic disorders. And so it is important for children on the long run to make sure that they have a regular physical regimen of some kind of outdoor activity, exercise. And I think in particular these days, the outdoor activities are helpful, especially given what we know about potential transmission of COVID in indoor settings and the physical exertion and heavy breathing and yelling that could potentially provide increased transmission of the virus in indoor settings, especially those that aren't well ventilated.
Right. So that brings me to my next question, which is how safe is, you know, outdoor play? There are a lot of youth leagues that have been doing practices and conditioning and training, but would like to start doing competitive games. I mean, How safe is it? What do we know about it, especially right now, when one of the things that we constantly hear is that we have to keep track of, you know, the amount of virus that's in the community, how much virus is really circulating to be able to help assess risk levels. So can you talk about safety of these types of activities?
Yeah. So I think, unfortunately, there really is very little known because we have only been through the summer, spring and summer and fall. The winter, of course, in many parts of the country, and even here in California, is going to be a little more challenging because it is colder. There may be rain or other climate issues that keep people from participating as actively in sports outside. But it really is a concern around transmission. We know, for example, there's one example that people bring up because it's hard to really track this at a national scale, but there was a hockey game in which one individual, these were older adults, older adolescents and adults, and in that group, one individual on one hockey team actually wound up infecting other people on the opposing team. So despite all of the the other practices, you know, hockey is an intense sport. There's a lot of heavy breathing and yelling and close contact, and there were several people infected, and at least 14 people infected that we know of, and potentially others who didn't get tested and were asymptomatic. So we only have that one example for indoor activities. I do think that as we get more into a high prevalence situation, it's really just an increase in risk for exposure. So close contact without masking in particular is going to be a risk. And I think not scaling back into close competitive sports might be a better idea, especially given the climate, during winter time, as well as the really increasing surge. This is really unprecedented surges that we're seeing all over the country, including here in the Bay Area.
Right. And so this is even if you're outdoors, even if these activities, games, practices are outdoors.
Well, I think that would be the case. Yeah. I mean, I think just having, especially if kids can't mask. So if they're not masking, I think that is really a concern because they can obviously expel droplets that can infect other kids. And if they're coming into close contact, we just know that the numbers are really, really high right now in all age groups.
So then are you actually recommending that people take a pause in terms of organized group play, that schools be more careful about kids during recess, or yeah?
No, I mean, I'd be interested to hear what Michelle has to say, but frankly, I don't think we should stop a physical activity. I think we just have to be much more careful and mindful about the kind of activities that the children are engaged in and make sure that they're not really coming into that close contact.
We're talking with Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Stanford, and Michelle Serrano, vice president of field operations for PlayWorks, which creates opportunities for kids to play outdoors as safely as possible. We know that play and active outdoor play is really critical for kids' development, but there are a lot of questions now with the rising surge in cases as to how to make that as safe as possible. Share your questions and thoughts. 866-733-6786 is the number. Again, 866-733-6786. Email address forum@kqed.org and @KQEDForum on Twitter or Facebook. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about elementary age kids, organized outdoor play during the pandemic, like sports, PE, and recess, their safety, and some ideas for what could be some good games with less contact. We're talking with Yvonne Maldonado, pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Stanford, and Michelle Serrano of PlayWorks. And you, our listeners, are with us. How are you keeping your kids physically active? You can share your tips. Are your kids involved in some form of group outdoor play or team sports? How has it been for your kid if they haven't been able to do team sports anymore? And what do you want to know about organizing outdoor play for your kids? Tips and best practices. Again, the number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. And Michelle Serrano, I'm wondering what kinds of games are you suggesting to school districts, examples of safe outdoor games and activities with less contact, as Dr. Maldonado is suggesting?
Yeah, definitely. I can share. So just the other day, I was talking with one of our coaches that's working at a school site in person, and Coach Stephanie, and she was sharing how much fun a small group of students had playing the game of Switch at recess. And Switch is a game where it can be played with as few as 4 or 5 students. And imagine sort of the setup of 4 corners, a box, or a 4-square court, where each of them are standing in a designated area. And when the coach or the student yells out the word Switch, they're finding their way to a new designated spot. So very easy to keep, you know, the physical distance of students, you know, not coming into close contact with each other. Very easy to, yeah, create either small or large spaces where they can run and get that heart rate up and be outside, and but also still feel like they're part of a game alongside other students. So that's a game that we've seen, again, played in small spaces, smaller spaces if the, you know, if it's limited outside, or, you know, much bigger grassy areas depending on the space available. So games like that, we're also seeing, like I was mentioning, relay races. We have a game called Rochambeau Relay, which is where students are playing rock, paper, scissors with each other. And we have coaches designating the areas they stand in by putting hula hoops on the ground. And you can, you know when you're moving to the next area, if you've successfully won that round of rock, paper, scissors, then you go to the next hula hoop area. So it's really great to think strategically about how to best support their play opportunities, even under these circumstances.
Well, we're joined now by Dr. Dan Cooper, professor of pediatrics at UC Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you.
And I invited you on because I understand that you are involved in a study that is looking at virus transmission, infection transmission in schools. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Like, what are you trying to determine with this study?
Well, thanks for having us on. At the very beginning of the pandemic, a group of us who had been doing research in the past on school issues. For example, our group had been studying the pandemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes, particularly in lower socioeconomic schools. We realized that the problem of closing the schools and then opening them would be enormous. And little did we realize how enormous it would become. And we actually put a paper that was published in Journal of Pediatrics. And we realized there were huge gaps in our knowledge, and we needed to understand what was going on with viral transmission in kids. Did they transmit to each other, and did they transmit to adults, which are critical questions for school reopening? And is it safer to be in school or out of school when, like right now, we're experiencing a surge in the country? I mean, there's no guarantee that just because kids are not in school that they won't transmit one to another and get it from adults. And so we actually got support from University of California at Irvine, from Children's Hospital of Orange County, and from Orange County Healthcare Agency to study viral transmission in 4 schools that represent the different kinds of schools. So one is a private school that deals predominantly with middle and upper middle class kids. 3 of the schools are in the Santa Ana Orange, which is a lower socioeconomic, predominantly minority area of our county, where the surge has been really, really excessive. And one of the schools is a school which deals predominantly with children with special needs like Down syndrome, where the idea of physical distancing is really almost impossible to achieve because of the nature of the interaction of teachers. We went through an IRB. We've had to have consent. We've had amazing responsiveness from the schools, even the kids that are not attending in person, and the teachers. And one of the aspects of our study was to look not only at nasal swabs for SARS-CoV-2 virus and for other co-circulating respiratory viruses, but we asked the kids that would be willing if they would donate a little bit of blood so we could look at the antibodies and other aspects. And about 80% of the kids, to our really great satisfaction, have agreed. So phase 1 is complete. We've studied about 200 children and about 50 or so of their teachers. We're going to be going back to these schools in a couple of weeks. We have this sad and unfortunate experiment of nature that when we originally did it, our numbers in Orange County and throughout the state were low, and now they're going to be very high. And it's going to be very interesting, and we think illustrative, to see what we're seeing in the kids at these 2 different time points.
Yes, but so far it sounds like from your earlier study that, or the earlier results, that you did not see a lot of spread at schools?
We did not see a lot of spread at schools. I don't think we had a single positive. We did, and our tests were working because we did see some rhinovirus. You know, we did see some of the more common viruses. So, you know, it's not like we were just getting total zeros. We also found about 6 or 7% of the kids that were in the higher impacted areas, like in Santa Ana, California, had evidence of prior exposure through antibodies. And the other thing that we did was, you know, it's one thing to tell a school or kids to practice mitigation efforts like face mask wearing and physical distancing. It's another thing to see if it actually works. And so we adapted an existing tool that had been used to quantify physical activity in schools called SOPLAY, which stands for Systematic Observation of Play and Leisure Activity in Youth. And we said, gee, why don't we add to this direct observational approach, looking at the fidelity of face mask wearing and physical distancing. And we're now in those four schools, and we're actually able to quantify the success with which mitigation procedures are occurring. So much so that the staff at the schools want to learn how to do this.
So you're saying the mitigation measures are effective, that they are working based on.
Yeah, we'd like results. To be able to quantify them. You know, it's one thing to say, hey, do this. It's another thing to say if people are actually doing it. Look, we've all experienced going to the supermarket and people, so, you know, wearing masks incorrectly, right? And so what about physical distancing and your discussion just now about, you know, physical activity on the playground and in recess? Can kids and do kids really maintain the physical distancing that's necessary?
Yeah.
So we think we have a way of actually quantifying that.
And you mentioned that one of the schools you're at has kids with special needs. I mean, are there any special considerations that we need to keep in mind for children with intellectual or different developmental issues on the playground, at recess, at PE, things like that?
Yes. So, of course, all public schools in California and throughout the country are mandated to care for these children. There are PE programs that are set up especially. But the special consideration is that almost anything you do with these kids requires close physical contact, much more so than you would have for kids that didn't have these needs. That's point number one. So, you know, are there special PPE considerations that we really need to address for the teachers and the aides who are dealing with these kids? The good news is we know from studies that have been done throughout hospitals in California and the country that even when you're in a COVID ward, if the healthcare workers wear their PPE correctly, there's really, really rare transmission of virus from these patients. And so at least there is a glimmer of hope there that if we deal correctly with the aides and the teachers, that they can, even if they assume that the kids may be maybe carriers, that they can protect themselves. And that's very important. And we want to study that as well.
Dr. Dan Cooper, Professor of Pediatrics at UC Irvine, thanks so much for sharing your study. And I know it's ongoing, and I'd be very curious to learn what you find as you start to do this in the schools during the surge that we're in right now and how that could affect things. Really appreciate having you on. Thanks so much, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you.
And let me go to some of our listeners who are calling in. I'll start with Andy in Carmel. Hi, Andy.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Thanks for having me on. I just had a couple of thoughts. I coach at the high school level a contact sport where physical distancing or social distancing is impossible. The kids are literally in each other's faces in this sport. And I have two teenagers myself that play that sport, sort of are suffering from the time and distance away from playing that sport at an intense level. Looking back, I think this period is going on a lot longer than I would like. It's annoyingly long, and I'm sort of hitching my wagon to, you know, vaccines and treatment measures that can address, you know, infection rates. However, having two teenagers myself that are specialized athletes and coaching a sport where specialization is becoming more and more prevalent, it has given the kids some time to connect with their bodies in different ways while remaining active, even if it's been on the individual level. Huh. And so it's sort of allowed them to maybe take a mental break from sort of being on that specialized sports train. Again, nobody wants to be back coaching more than I do. I think my kids would want to warp speed to, you know, being back in the playing field. But looking back and looking at, you know, ways that they've been able to even just connect with themselves and look at their identities differently from, hey, I'm, you know, so-and-so the athlete versus I'm so-and-so who's healthy and I have an active body and an active lifestyle, and sort of taking their self-esteem from other, or learning to take their self-esteem from other avenues because they've been forced to. And so there, you know, again, as annoyingly long as this has been, there have been some positives to forcing kids to sort of reorient and look at their approach to their sport that they love differently, and maybe going forward. So that's been sort of my observations over the last year.
Wow. Well, thanks so much for sharing that. And what sport do you coach?
So I coach water polo. So again, it's a contact sport. Kids are literally, you know, in each other's faces. There's, you know, multiple instances of transmission. So it's, you know, again, like I said, I'm sort of hitching my wagon to the, you know, hopefully vaccines and treatment measures that can address, you know, any flare-ups of the virus. But there's no getting around the way that we practice or the way that we play in terms of the closeness and, you know, intimacy. Yes. It's like wrestling or, you know, any other sport that involves that physical contact. So that's not going to change.
Well, Andy, thanks so much for sharing all of that. And it inspires me to think of a couple of things, Dr. Maldonado. One of them, of course, is that we know that California right now is one of a handful of sports that's prohibiting youth sports games. Training, conditioning, things like that are allowed. And there has been some suggestion that they will further delay guidance related to games as well and allowing games. First, do you agree with this? And second, based on what Andy's saying about the potential benefits and value of the training process of maybe in terms of a little bit of a reset or a break from the intensity of competition, how we can benefit and enjoy that time, even if kids are dying to get out there and compete?
Yeah, you know, I think right now is a, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but we are in a surge that we have not seen before. And it's a really startling surge. And it is primarily being driven by young adults around the state and around the country, actually. So these are teachers, coaches, ages, you know, older high school students, et cetera. And I do think this is the right thing to do at this time, at least until we understand a little bit more. We really don't understand why the virus doesn't affect children in the same way as it does in adults. I'm also conducting my own school study as well as a household transmission study and working with one of the large school districts in California to see once they reopen how we can do that. But all of those things involve very intensive testing. And this is something that unfortunately we don't have available yet. So we all know, I know some of the students have talked about, well, you know, the NBA has a bubble, MLB has a bubble, NFL, et cetera. And even the Pac-12, for example, our conferences have bubbles, but they have extensive resources to be testing for this constant contact. And I'm telling you, these kids are getting really intensive protocols, which you just cannot do for youth sports. And I think at this point, it really does make sense until we get a better handle on this, or there's a better way to protocolize and operationalize routine screening in a really much finer way. What your caller said is really heartening, that the kids can do other things. And I think Michelle has also pointed out there's a number of other ways that children and young adults can really engage in new ways to stay physically fit and stay physically aware of their own capacities and build on those until we do have some good interventions.
And just as a quick follow, because you were mentioning that we really don't understand why it seems like transmission is lower among kids, especially under 10. What do we know, though? I know there's a lot we don't know, but so far the data are bearing out that transmission or maybe not transmission, but essentially kids who show symptoms, right, of COVID-19, it's far less in children under 10, correct?
Right. So we know from the national data, and this is from the American Academy, they're the only group that has pulled the national data together on children. We know that now there are over 1 million children who have documented infections, but they represent maybe 10 to 15% of overall infections in the country, and about that number of hospitalizations as well. Their hospitalization rate is pretty low, and the mortality rate is extremely low, not to minimize it, but it's probably on the order of what we would see for influenza every year in children. So there are some risks there, but they're not as high as in adults. And that's what we do know. So we know kids can get infected. They can infect others. We know that from child care center studies that children have been able to infect their family members. We have a case, for example, of an 8-month-old who was the parents were both infected from that child who attended a daycare center. But what's interesting is primarily what we've seen is that the primary source of infections in settings, school settings or daycare settings, is primarily the staff, not always the children. So there may be something different, and there's a number of theories. Some are based on maybe receptors for the virus being less dense on children, pediatric respiratory cells. But there's also data that perhaps the immune response in kids is a little different, or different enough that it may mute the ability of children to get sick. But it doesn't account for why children may not be as likely to get infected, especially the very young. So there's a lot more to learn, but so far, pretty decent news. I would say the one concern that we still continue to ponder is the risk of heart disease once children have become infected. We know that's true in adults, and for the few children who've had the more severe end of disease, that the heart risks or the cardiac risks are the ones that people are most concerned about.
And again, Dr. Yvonne Maldonado is a pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Stanford. Michelle Serrano is vice president of field operations for PlayWorks. We know that young kids have been doing sports, team sports, organized outdoor play now for some time at schools and in sports leagues with rare outbreaks. So what are we learning about how to do outdoor organized play safely? How can we apply these activities at home to keep kids healthy, especially right now as the state experiences a surge? Share with us how you're keeping your kids physically active and what questions you have at 866-733-6786. And we'll take your calls right after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about outdoor play. We know how important it is to children's healthy development, but how risky are outdoor sports or group sports right now amid this winter surge that we're experiencing? What are questions you have for Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, our pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Stanford, or Michelle Serrano, our expert in play, vice president of field operations for PlayWorks, which advises school districts on how to do recess and play safely during the pandemic? What would you like to know about organizing outdoor play for kids? Maybe you're an educator or coach. What are you doing to keep the kids you teach engaged in physical activity while they can't compete? And how has it been for your kids not to actually compete in sports anymore? Again, 866-733-6786 is the number. You can also reach us on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And Eric in San Francisco, join us. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I'm the father of a 7-year-old. And she is not in school, but I was asking about individual play dates, kind of a one-on-one thing. Is this something that can be done safely, or do you see that as a non-essential additional risk?
Michelle Serrano, thoughts for Eric?
Yeah, I think, hi, Eric. I think we are seeing at schools, groups of small, you know, small groups of students that are grouped together, like we were saying, in the classroom, that then come out and play in small groups outside. So I would, you know, defer to Dr. Maldonado also, but I would say there are certainly lots of activities you could offer to two students or two kids that are playing together outside, you know, that are physically distant, that we have available. We have a number of free resources on our website, which is playworks.org. We also have, we've grouped our some of our favorite Playworks games into what we refer to as a Safe Return to Play guide. And it lists the games and has links to how to play them. And they're kind of in a low, medium, and high risk category, just as parents and educators and schools prepare to return. But certainly I know there's a lot that goes into what happens, you know, where are those students or kids before they come together and play. But I definitely think there are a number of games that could be offered.
Well, Eric, thanks. I don't know, Dr. Maldonado, if you have anything you want to add.
Well, I would just be very careful about play dates to make sure, as you heard, that we, you know, that you know something about the, it does get a little personal. I know that this is a really strange time where we have to be very respectful of each other's privacy, but at the same time, measure the risks that we have among them, our own family. So one of the guidances is to be very respectful, but to say, you know, are you, if this is somebody you haven't been with before, then I'd really want to know a little bit more about who that family is in contact with. Are they being safe and careful, because the child could, you know, be, could potentially be infected or infectious. And in general, and I think Michelle has mentioned this as well, if you have small pods of people who you already have an established relationship with, that's probably the best way. So one or two children and families where you really have some kind of an understanding about how limited you are in terms of your outside exposures, and then you can have your those children engaging in activities together. That would probably be the better way, and just to make sure there's some ground rules.
Well, thanks, Eric, for the call. And speaking of which, Michelle Serrano, I know that you have talked about cohorting as an important way of controlling outbreaks at schools. Can you explain how that works and give us some examples?
Yeah, I think what we've learned from our school districts and our school partners, how they structure it is, you know, it's certainly, there's been a number of surveys and the ways that they've engaged. I think all of their parents and community members is remarkable as we're all kind of working through this together for the first time. And so the way we've seen our school partners do it is by grouping students, again, typically based on their grade levels and within small groups within classrooms, and then kind of keeping them within that same small cohort throughout the day, whether it's in for their in-person in-class instruction, or as they transition to outside play, or as they transition to their lunchtime. So it's we've seen schools take great caution and measure in how they're grouping those students together, and then how they kind of create their own community and their own little cohort, like we were saying, throughout the course of the days and the weeks. And of course, we've seen a lot of, you know, hybrid schedules and different students coming in together for on certain days. So tons of innovation and response from our school partners going into how they thoughtfully bring students back onto campus.
Well, this listener writes, when we were in the orange tier, I organized an event to bring together a group of eight families in a parking lot. We have mixed age children, and some smaller ones have trouble maintaining distance and wearing masks. We are so starved for gathering. I thought I'd organize a safe outdoor event. Now I'm thinking of canceling. Any guidance? Dr. Maldonado, before you also answer that listener's question, if you have guidance to share, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about as I was preparing for this segment is just how much we're really asking parents to do. I mean, to some extent, we are asking them to sort of undertake some sophisticated sort of risk assessment under potentially very high stakes.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that it's really confusing, and I understand that. And unfortunately, part of why this is confusing is that we just don't have any answers. And it's really, a lot of it is Well, there's two major factors. One is, what is the risk in your community? So right now we know that pretty much in the entire country right now, the risk is pretty high that you're going to come into contact with somebody who is infected, because we're seeing this surge. And so, you know, 5 to 10% of people that, you know, are going to be infected more or less. So if you're talking about, you know, 1 out of 20 people, if you get a group of 20 people together, there will be one person infected. And that's statistical, obviously. Then the second issue is, what's your degree of risk tolerance? Some people really think, well, you know, I don't think, you know, we are pretty healthy. I don't really see that the risk, 1 in 20 is not a bad thing for me. I'm going to be very careful, and I think I can minimize that risk. And others just aren't willing to take that risk, especially people with conditions that could put them at higher risk for serious outcomes. So it is very difficult. I think it really has to be an individual level. If you, for example, have put all this time and effort into organizing people, and that's already a big feat in and of itself, all by yourself, and you really trust this group and you can keep the bigger kids away, and you know, the small ones, you know, you can try to do what you can. I mean, I think you can go a long way to, you know, making sure you can clean their hands, make sure that they're as much as possible staying apart from the other kids, or making sure they clean hands before they approach their own family members, so at least they can, you know, minimize any potential transmissions. And I think it is healthy to try to get out there. But if you feel like it's too big a group, or maybe some of the kids are just not going to be able to behave in the way that we would like them to, and obviously they're young children, that's just their natural tendency, then, you know, I think it's a risk calculation. So it is, and I feel, you know, my kids are grown up, but I can imagine what it's like today to try to have to juggle that and do what's best for your kids and your families, especially during the holidays. So I would just say, do what you know, go with your own instinct around what you understand about these other families, recognizing that we are trying to keep people apart because the risk is just going up. I mean, we are at least double the risk of encountering an infected person right now.
Well, Mike asks, for outdoor sports like soccer, what precautions should kids take to stay safe while practicing? Michelle Serrano, what do you recommend for sports like soccer or games like that at schools in terms of precautions that kids should take to stay safe?
Yeah, I mean, we're fortunate enough to have a large game library of games that actually don't have any equipment. And so we know when students are not required to share the same piece of equipment or potentially touch one ball and then pass it to another friend, then of course that already feels less risky, right? So I think we're really focused on encouraging our schools to focus in those areas, especially with younger students. There's just so many opportunities to have meaningful play, even in the absence of equipment. But certainly when you think about games that require equipment, things like soccer, and if students have their own access to their own individual ball and can do more like skills building activities or actions and kind of stay in a designated area versus playing a more traditional version of the sport where of course, passing with your feet is better than passing with your hands. But we do know even with soccer, right, there are throw-ins and goalies. So they're just different layers for you know, schools and parents and educators to think through. And that's where hopefully we can help them kind of find what options make the most sense for their play spaces and their age groups.
And Michelle Serrano, any thoughts on this, or has this come up when you're talking with schools? The listener writes, advice on avoiding confrontation when encountering grownups who aren't respecting children's play spaces, such as playgrounds and fields. I feel like the communication piece of this is very important at all levels.
Yes, I mean, definitely. And we talk about all the great skills you do learn by playing and, you know, your cooperative skills and your listening skills. Conflict resolution is certainly one that we learn through play. But I think, yeah, exactly. I think if we can come to a place of like respectful communication and acknowledge what everybody's trying to accomplish on a shared space, we haven't seen, you know, much conflict there, especially when we can all agree the priority, you know, with having kids, you know, kids anywhere have access to safe play. And when all else fails, we always encourage a good old-fashioned rock, paper, scissors battle.
Again, Michelle Serrano is Vice President of Field Operations for PlayWorks, an organization that creates opportunities for kids to play as safely as possible and has been advising school districts on how to effectively organize recess and play. Dr. Yvonne Maldonado is a pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Stanford. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Join the conversation 866-733-6786. Let me go to Mike in Menlo Park. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was wondering if you have any advice at the other end of the spectrum for the needs of college athletes who, you guys had touched on it earlier, they've been in a bubble in lots of instances where they've been on campus and subject to training and testing and all that kind of thing. But now that they're home for 6 weeks, you know, they can do personal conditioning, but they also need to keep training in their sports skills, and that's going to require training partners. So I'm curious what kind of risk assessment and other kind of mitigations we should be looking at. I mean, we're reintegrating our own student athlete here at our house, so we're doing some sequestering and everybody's wearing masks and we're waiting for test results to come back, but the training has to continue and we're looking for, you know, how he does that best on an ad hoc basis.
Dr. Bamaldo, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what Michelle says, but yeah, certainly I've been involved here with the Pac-12 and helping them understand some of the infectious disease and epidemiologic principles. There are, as you've probably heard me say earlier, there are just so many protocols in place. It's a really whole separate infrastructure that has been set up for our student athletes. And so I really would turn back to the coaches for the individual sports. If these are students who are in an organized division or intramural activities, that they should have some guidance from their team coaches. Because I personally think that whatever they're doing should probably involve a lot of individual training, and they would probably need some guidance as to how to do that over the 6 week holidays. Usually the coaches, if anything, are pretty prescriptive about what they want their athletes to do. My two of my three children were really intensely into sports in high school and college. And my younger one was theater. So different kind of activity there, but they had regimens worked out. So I would really do that. If you have any questions, I think talking to somebody like Michelle's group or even to your local pediatric provider or medical provider to find out more information about what is acceptable. You want to keep them obviously in condition because, reduce the risk of injuries when they come back. So I think that would be the main thing. And of course, the distancing piece is really important. If you're in a place, obviously they're in California, but if they are somewhere else where they can't be outside, then, you know, how do you exercise properly? I mean, running is easy in any weather, just about, unless you're in a blizzard, but other conditioning may need to be done in a safe space where there's nobody else around and decrease risk of potential transmissions.
Well, thanks, Mike, for the call. Let me go to Douglas in San Leandro. Hi, Douglas.
Good morning. I have a 12 and a 14-year-old at home, and they're missing their friends. They're missing sports. They're socially distanced at school. We've done the distance birthday party and the distance masked biking in Richmond. But I'm wondering if your guests have seen this new study out of Princeton, which studied a couple provinces in the south of India, and seems to indicate that contrary to the political lore, that the children might actually be serving a role as super spreaders. It's definitely given me some pause, and I'm wondering what they might think it means in terms of trying to arrange outdoor sports.
Dr. Maldonado, are you familiar with this study?
No, I haven't seen that study, but I personally am not a big fan of the word super spreader because it's just a catch-all phrase that means we don't really know what's going on, but somehow there was an outbreak or there's this clusters. So until we really understand what we mean by super spreaders, I don't really think that most of the people in the field think there's a kind of person who's a super spreader, but rather there may be events or environmental factors that allow for increased transmission. So what we thought were quote unquote super spreading events were basically places where there was poor ventilation, people weren't wearing masks, there wasn't social distancing. So these are just a combination of factors. And I didn't read the paper that was referred to, but I do think that if we can avoid those kinds of events, I have not seen risks of mass exposures and infections when people are taking those precautions. So I suspect that there may have been some breaches in precautions, but again, I can't speak directly to this issue. And I don't think children, there's just no evidence that children are at higher risk for transmitting to others than others, all things being equal. Now, remember, you have a 12 and a 14-year-old. Sometimes what we're hearing is, you know, people sneak out to go visit their friends. They are starved for attention. I'm not saying that's what's happening in here in this case, but you know, it is more likely for the older kids to try to behave in certain events and not in others. And there is a study showing among contact tracing of people who are exposed that not wearing a mask wearing a mask sometimes is equally as effective as not wearing a mask. So keeping a distance of at least 3 to 6 feet is actually very, very effective. And sometimes washing your hands is actually better than not. So the point here is that if you sometimes wear a mask, you almost might not wear a mask at all. And I don't want to say it that way, but I just think that the events are linked to probably practices more than individual biological factors.
Well, Michelle Serrano, in the last 10 seconds, I know you have a 3 and 5-year-old, a pro tip for trying to keep little kids to keep their masks on.
Yeah, I mean, we've been surprised, not just in my family, but across schools, how well they do respond to similarly, wash your hands after you go to the bathroom, you know, clear your plate after you eat dinner. So I think it is, they're remarkable at the way that they can respond to the encouragements that we offer.
Well, Michelle Serrano, Yvonne Maldonado, thanks to both of you for coming on and talking with us. And thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments, and to Polly Stryker for producing this segment. I'm Mina Kim. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.